There's still plenty of money to be made by anyone who isn't afraid of work. Or to grab. She saw Frank coming across the floor toward her, with a glass of blackberry wine in his hand and a morsel of cake on a saucer, and she pulled her face into a smile. It did not occur to her to question whether Tara was worth marrying Frank. She knew it was worth it, and she never gave the matter a second thought. She smiled up at him as she sipped the wine, knowing that her cheeks were more attractively pink than any of the dancers. She moved her skirts for him to sit by her and waved her handkerchief idly so that the faint sweet smell of the cologne could reach his nose. She was proud of the cologne, for no other woman in the room was wearing any, and Frank had noticed it. In a fit of daring, he had whispered to her that she was as pink and fragrant as a rose. If only he were not so shy. He reminded her of a timid old brown field rabbit. If only he had the gallantry and ardor of the Tarleton boys, or even the coarse impudence of Rhett Butler. But if he possessed those qualities, he'd probably have sense enough to feel the desperation that lurked just beneath her demurely fluttering eyelids. As it was, he didn't know enough about women even to suspect what she was up to. That was her good fortune. But it didn't increase her respect for him. Chapter 36. She married Frank Kennedy 2 weeks later, after a whirlwind courtship, which she blushingly told him left her too breathless to oppose his ardor any longer. He didn't know that during those 2 weeks she had walked the floor at night, gritting her teeth at the slowness with which he took hints and encouragements, praying that no untimely letter from Sue Ellen would reach him and ruin her plans. She thanked God that her sister was the poorest of correspondents, delighting to receive letters and disliking to write them. But there was always a chance, always a chance. She thought in the long night hours as she padded back and forth across the cold floor of her bedroom, with Ellen's faded shawl clutched about her nightdress. Frank didn't know she had received a laconic letter from Will, relating that Jonas Wilkerson had paid another call at Tara, and finding her gone to Atlanta, had stormed about until Will and Ashley threw him bodily off the place. Will's letter hammered into her mind the fact she knew only too well, that time was getting shorter and shorter before the extra taxes must be paid. A fierce desperation drove her, as she saw the days slipping by, and she wished she might grasp the hourglass in her hands and keep the sands from running. But so well did she conceal her feelings, so well did she enact her role, Frank suspected nothing. Saw no more than what lay on the surface. The pretty and helpless young widow of Charles Hamilton, who greeted him every night in Miss Pittipat's parlor, and listened, breathless with admiration, as he told of future plans for his store and how much money he expected to make when he was able to buy the sawmill. Her sweet sympathy and her bright-eyed interest in every word he uttered were balm upon the wound left by Sue Ellen's supposed defection. His heart was sore and bewildered at Sue Ellen's conduct, and his vanity, the shy, touchy vanity of a middle-aged bachelor who knows himself to be unattractive to women, was deeply wounded. He couldn't write Sue Ellen upbraiding her for her faithlessness. He shrank from the very idea. But he could ease his heart by talking about her to Scarlett. Without saying a disloyal word about Sue Ellen, she could tell him she understood how badly her sister had treated him, and what good treatment he merited from a woman who really appreciated him. Little Mrs. Hamilton was such a pretty pink-cheeked person, alternating between melancholy sighs, when she thought of her sad plight, and laughter as gay and sweet as the tinkling of tiny silver bells when he made small jokes to cheer her. Her green gown, now neatly cleaned by Mammy, showed off her slender figure with its tiny waist to perfection, and how bewitching was the faint fragrance which always clung about her handkerchief and her hair. It was a shame that such a fine little woman should be alone and helpless in a world so rough that she didn't even understand its harshness. No husband, nor brother, nor even a father now to protect her. Frank thought the world too rude a place for a lone woman. And in that idea, Scarlett silently and heartily concurred. He came to call every night, for the atmosphere of Pity's house was pleasant and soothing. Mammy's smile at the front door was a smile reserved for quality folks. Pity served him coffee laced with brandy and fluttered about him, and Scarlett hung on his every utterance. Sometimes in the afternoons he took Scarlett riding with him in his buggy when he went out on business. These rides were merry affairs because she asked so many foolish questions. "Just like a woman," he told himself approvingly. He couldn't help laughing at her ignorance about business matters, and she laughed too, saying, "Well, of course, you can't expect a silly little woman like me to understand men's affairs." She made him feel, for the first time in his old maidish life, that he was a strong, upstanding man fashioned by God in a nobler mold than other men, fashioned to protect silly, helpless women. When, at last, they stood together to be married, her confiding little hand in his, and her downcast lashes throwing thick black crescents on her pink cheeks, he still did not know how it all came about. He only knew he had done something romantic and exciting for the first time in his life. He, Frank Kennedy, had swept this lovely creature off her feet and into his strong arms. That was a heady feeling. No friend or relative stood up with him at their marriage. The witnesses were strangers called in from the street. Scarlett had insisted on that, and he had given in, though reluctantly, for he would have liked his sister and his brother-in-law from Jonesboro to be with him. And a reception with toast drunk to the bride in Miss Pity's parlor, amid happy friends, would have been a joy to him. But Scarlett would not hear of even Miss Pity being present. "Just us two, Frank," she begged, squeezing his arm. "Like an elopement. I always did want to run away and be married. Please, sweetheart. Just for me." It was that endearing term, still so new to his ears, and the bright teardrops which edged her pale green eyes as she looked up pleadingly at him, that won him over. After all, a man had to make some concessions to his bride, especially about the wedding, for women set such a store by sentimental things. And before he knew it, he was married. Frank gave her $300, bewildered by her sweet urgency, reluctant at first, because it meant the end of his hope of buying the sawmill immediately. But he couldn't see her family evicted, and his disappointment soon faded at the sight of her radiant happiness, disappeared entirely at the loving way she took on over his generosity. Frank had never before had a woman take on over him, and he came to feel that the money had been well spent after all. Scarlett dispatched Mammy to Terra immediately for the triple purpose of giving Will the money, announcing her marriage, and bringing Wade to Atlanta. In 2 days she had a brief note from Will, which she carried about with her, and read and reread with mounting joy. Will wrote that the taxes had been paid, and Jonas Wilkerson acted up pretty bad at the news, but had made no other threat so far. Will closed by wishing her happiness, a laconic formal statement which he qualified in no way. She knew Will understood what she had done and why she had done it, and neither blamed nor praised. But what must Ashley think? She wondered feverishly. What must he think of me now, after what I said to him so short a while ago in the orchard at Tara? She also had a letter from Sue Ellen, poorly spelled, violent, abusive, tear-splotched. A letter so full of venom and truthful observations upon her character that she was never to forget it, nor forgive the writer. But even Sue Ellen's words could not dim her happiness that Tara was safe, at least from immediate danger. It was hard to realize that Atlanta and not Tara was her permanent home now. In her desperation to obtain the tax money, no thought save Tara and the fate which threatened it had any place in her mind. Even at the moment of marriage, she had not given a thought to the fact that the price she was paying for the safety of home was permanent exile from it. Now that the deed was done, she realized this with a wave of homesickness hard to dispel. But there it was. She had made her bargain, and she intended to stand by it. And she was so grateful to Frank for saving Tara, she felt a warm affection for him, and an equally warm determination that he should never regret marrying her. The ladies of Atlanta knew their neighbor's business only slightly less completely than they knew their own, and were far more interested in it. They all knew that for years Frank Kennedy had had an understanding with Sue Ellen O'Hara. In fact, he had said, sheepishly, that he expected to get married in the spring. So the tumult of gossip, surmise, and deep suspicion which followed the announcement of his quiet wedding to Scarlett was not surprising. Mrs. Merriweather, who never let her curiosity go long unsatisfied if she could help it, asked him point-blank just what he meant by marrying one sister when he was betrothed to the other. She reported to Mrs. Elsing that all the answer she got for her pains was a silly look. Not even Mrs. Merriweather, doughty soul that she was, dared to approach Scarlett on the subject. Scarlett seemed demure and sweet enough these days, but there was a pleased complacency in her eyes which annoyed people, and she carried a chip on her shoulder which no one cared to disturb. She knew Atlanta was talking, but she didn't care. After all, there wasn't anything immoral in marrying a man. Tara was safe. Let people talk. She had too many other matters to occupy her mind. The most important was how to make Frank realize, in a tactful manner, that his store should bring in more money. After the fright Jonas Wilkerson had given her, she would never rest easy until she and Frank had some money ahead. And even if no emergency developed, Frank would need to make more money if she was going to save enough for next year's taxes. Moreover, what Frank had said about the sawmill stuck in her mind. Frank could make lots of money out of a mill. Anybody could, with lumber selling at such outrageous prices. She fretted silently because Frank's money had not been enough to pay the taxes on Tara and buy the mill as well. And she made up her mind that he had to make more money on the store somehow, and do it quickly, so he could buy that mill before someone else snapped it up. She could see it was a bargain. If she were a man, she would have that mill, if she had to mortgage the store to raise the money. But when she intimated this delicately to Frank, the day after they married, he smiled and told her not to bother her sweet, pretty little head about business matters. It had come as a surprise to him that she even knew what a mortgage was, and at first he was amused. But this amusement quickly passed, and a sense of shock took its place in the early days of their marriage. Once, incautiously, he had told her that people, he was careful not to mention names, owed him money, but couldn't pay just now, and he was, of course, unwilling to press old friends and gentlefolk. Frank regretted ever mentioning it, for thereafter she had questioned him about it again and again. She had the most charmingly childlike air. but she was just curious, she said, to know who owed him and how much they owed. Frank was very evasive about the matter. He coughed nervously and waved his hands and repeated his annoying remark about her sweet, pretty little head. It had begun to dawn on him that this same sweet, pretty little head was a good head for figures. In fact, a much better one than his own, and the knowledge was disquieting. He was thunderstruck to discover that she could swiftly add a long column of figures in her head when he needed a pencil and paper for more than three figures. And fractions presented no difficulties to her at all. He felt there was something unbecoming about a woman understanding fractions and business matters, and he believed that should a woman be so unfortunate as to have such unladylike comprehension, she should pretend not to. Now he disliked talking business with her as much as he had enjoyed it before they were married. Then he had thought it all beyond her mental grasp, and it had been pleasant to explain things to her. Now he saw that she understood entirely too well, and he felt the usual masculine indignation at the duplicity of women. Added to it was the usual masculine disillusionment in discovering that a woman has a brain. Just how early in his married life Frank learned of the deception Scarlett had used in marrying him, no one ever knew. Perhaps the truth dawned on him when Tony Fontaine, obviously fancy-free, came to Atlanta on business. Perhaps it was told him more directly in letters from his sister in Jonesboro, who was astounded at his marriage. Certainly he never learned from Sue Ellen herself. She never wrote him, and naturally he couldn't write her and explain. What good would explanations do anyway, now that he was married? He writhed inwardly at the thought that Sue Ellen would never know the truth, and would always think he had senselessly jilted her. Perhaps everyone else was thinking this too, and criticizing him. It certainly put him in an awkward position, and he had no way of clearing himself, for a man couldn't go about saying he had lost his head about a woman, and a gentleman couldn't advertise the fact that his wife had entrapped him with a lie. Scarlett was his wife, and a wife was entitled to the loyalty of her husband. Furthermore, he couldn't bring himself to believe she had married him coldly, and with no affection for him at all. His masculine vanity wouldn't permit such a thought to stay long in his mind. It was more pleasant to think she had fallen so suddenly in love with him. She had been willing to lie to get him. But it was all very puzzling. He knew he was no great catch for a woman half his age, and pretty and smart to boot. But Frank was a gentleman, and he kept his bewilderment to himself. Scarlett was his wife, and he couldn't insult her by asking awkward questions, which, after all, wouldn't remedy matters. Not that Frank especially wanted to remedy matters, for it appeared that his marriage would be a happy one. Scarlett was the most charming and exciting of women, and he thought her perfect in all things, except that she was so headstrong. Frank learned early in his marriage that so long as she had her own way, life could be very pleasant. But when she was opposed, given her own way, she was as gay as a child, laughed a good deal, made foolish little jokes, sat on his knee and tweaked his beard until he vowed he felt 20 years younger. She could be unexpectedly sweet and thoughtful, having his slippers toasting at the fire when he came home at night, fussing affectionately about his wet feet and interminable head colds, remembering that he always liked the gizzard of the chicken and 3 spoonfuls of sugar in his coffee. Yes. Life was very sweet and cozy with Scarlett, as long as she had her own way. When the marriage was 2 weeks old, Frank contracted the grip and Dr. Meade put him to bed. In the first year of the war, Frank had spent 2 months in the hospital with pneumonia, and he had lived in dread of another attack since that time, so he was only too glad to lie sweating under 3 blankets and drink the hot concoctions Mammy and Aunt Pity brought him every hour. The illness dragged on, and Frank worried more and more about the store as each day passed. The place was in charge of the counter boy, who came to the house every night to report on the day's transactions, but Frank wasn't satisfied. He fretted until Scarlett, who had only been waiting for such an opportunity, laid a cool hand on his forehead and said, "Now, sweetheart, I shall be vexed if you take on so. I'll go to town and see how things are." And she went, smiling as she smothered his feeble protests. During the 3 weeks of her new marriage, she had been in a fever to see his account books and find out just how money matters stood. What luck that he was bedridden! The store stood near Five Points, its new roof glaring against the smoked bricks of the old walls. Wooden awnings covered the sidewalk to the edge of the street. And at the long iron bars connecting the uprights, horses and mules were hitched, their heads bowed against the cold, misty rain, their backs covered with torn blankets and quilts. The inside of the store was almost like Bullard's store in Jonesboro, except that there were no loungers about the roaring red-hot stove, whittling and spitting streams of tobacco juice at the sandboxes. It was bigger than Bullard's store, and much darker. The wooden awnings cut off most of the winter daylight, and the interior was dim and dingy, only a trickle of light coming in through the small fly-specked windows high up on the side walls. The floor was covered with muddy sawdust, and everywhere was dust and dirt. There was a semblance of order in the front of the store, where tall shelves rose into the gloom stacked with bright bolts of cloth, china, cooking utensils and notions. But in the back, behind the partition, chaos reigned. Here there was no flooring, and the assorted jumble of stock was piled helter-skelter on the hard-packed earth. In the semi-darkness she saw boxes and bales of goods, plows and harness and saddles and cheap pine coffins. Second-hand furniture, ranging from cheap gum to mahogany and rosewood, reared up in the gloom, and the rich but worn brocade and horsehair upholstery gleamed incongruously in the dingy surroundings. China chambers and bowl and pitcher sets littered the floor, and all around the four walls were deep bins, so dark she had to hold the lamp directly over them to discover they contained seeds, nails, bolts, and carpenter's tools. "I'd think a man as fussy and old-maidish as Frank would keep things tidier," she thought, scrubbing her griming hands with her handkerchief. "This place is a pig pen. What a way to run a store! If he'd only dust up this stuff and put it out in front where folks could see it, he could sell things much quicker. And if his stock was in such condition, what mustn't his accounts be?" "I'll look at his account book now," she thought, and picking up the lamp, she went into the front of the store. Willie, the counter boy, was reluctant to give her the large, dirty-backed ledger. It was obvious that, young as he was, he shared Frank's opinion that women had no place in business. But Scarlett silenced him with a sharp word and sent him out to get his dinner. She felt better when he was gone, for his disapproval annoyed her, and she settled herself in a split-bottomed chair by the roaring stove, tucked 1 foot under her, and spread the book across her lap. It was dinner time, and the streets were deserted. No customers called, and she had the store to herself. She turned the pages slowly, narrowly scanning the rows of names and figures written in Frank's cramped, copper-plate hand. It was just as she had expected. and she frowned as she saw this newest evidence of Frank's lack of business sense. At least $500 in debts, some of them months old, were set down against the names of people she knew well, the Merriweathers and the Elsings, among other familiar names. From Frank's deprecatory remarks about the money people owed him, she had imagined the sums to be small. But this... "If they can't pay, why do they keep on buying?" she thought irritably. "And if he knows they can't pay, why does he keep on selling them stuff? Lots of them could pay if he'd just make them do it. The Elsings certainly could, if they could give Fanny a new satin dress and an expensive wedding. Frank's just too soft-hearted, and people take advantage of him. Why, if he'd collected half this money, he could have bought the sawmill and easily spared me the tax money, too." Then she thought, just imagine Frank trying to operate a sawmill, God's nightgown. If he runs this store like a charitable institution, how could he expect to make money on a mill? The sheriff would have it in a month. Why, I could run this store better than he does. And I could run a mill better than he could, even if I don't know anything about the lumber business. A startling thought, this. That a woman could handle business matters as well as, or better than, a man. A revolutionary thought to Scarlett, who had been reared in the tradition that men were omniscient and women none too bright. Of course, she had discovered that this was not altogether true, but the pleasant fiction still stuck in her mind. Never before had she put this remarkable idea into words. She sat quite still, with a heavy book across her lap, her mouth a little open with surprise, thinking that during the lean months at Terra she had done a man's work, and done it well. She had been brought up to believe that a woman alone could accomplish nothing. Yet she had managed the plantation without men to help her until Will came. Why, her mind stuttered. I believe women could manage everything in the world without men's help, except having babies. And God knows, no woman in her right mind would have babies if she could help it. With the idea that she was as capable as a man came a sudden rush of pride and a violent longing to prove it, to make money for herself as men made money. Money which would be her own, which she would neither have to ask for nor account for to any man. "I wish I had enough money to buy that mill myself," she said aloud and sighed. "I'd sure make it hum. And I wouldn't let even one splinter go out on credit." She sighed again. There was nowhere she could get any money, so the idea was out of the question. Frank would simply have to collect this money owing him and buy the mill. It was a sure way to make money, and when he got the mill, she would certainly find some way to make him be more businesslike in its operation than he had been with the store. She pulled a back page out of the ledger and began copying the list of debtors who had made no payments in several months. She'd take the matter up with Frank just as soon as she reached home. She'd make him realize that these people had to pay their bills, even if they were old friends, even if it did embarrass him to press them for money. That would probably upset Frank, for he was timid and fond of the approbation of his friends. He was so thin-skinned he'd rather lose the money than be businesslike about collecting it. And he'd probably tell her that no one had any money with which to pay him. Well, perhaps that was true. Poverty was certainly no news to her. But nearly everybody had saved some silver or jewelry or was hanging on to a little real estate. Frank could take them in lieu of cash. She could imagine how Frank would moan when she broached such an idea to him. Take the jewelry and property of his friends? Well, she shrugged, he can moan all he likes. I'm going to tell him that he may be willing to stay poor for friendship's sake, but I'm not. Frank will never get anywhere if he doesn't get up some gumption. And he's got to get somewhere. He's got to make money, even if I've got to wear the pants in the family to make him do it. She was writing busily, her face screwed up with the effort, her tongue clamped between her teeth. When the front door opened and a great draft of cold wind swept the store, a tall man came into the dingy room, walking with a light Indian-like tread. And looking up, she saw Rhett Butler. He was resplendent in new clothes and a great coat with a dashing cape thrown back from his heavy shoulders. His tall hat was off in a deep bow when her eyes met his and his hand went to the bosom of a spotless pleated shirt. His white teeth gleamed startlingly against his brown face, and his bold eyes raked her. "My dear Mrs. Kennedy," he said, walking toward her, "my very dear Mrs. Kennedy." And he broke into a loud, merry laugh. At first, she was as startled as if a ghost had invaded the store, and then hastily removing her foot from beneath her, she stiffened her spine and gave him a cold stare. "What are you doing here?"
"I called on Miss Pittypat and learned of your marriage, and so I hastened here to congratulate you." The memory of her humiliation at his hands made her go crimson with shame.
"I don't see how you have the gall to face me," she cried.
"On the contrary, how have you the gall to face me?"
"Oh, you are the most—"
"Shall we let the bugles sing truce?" He smiled down at her, a wide, flashing smile that had impudence in it, but no shame for his own actions or condemnation for hers. In spite of herself, she had to smile too, but it was a wry, uncomfortable smile.
"What a pity they didn't hang you."
"Others share your feeling, I fear. Come, Scarlet, relax. You look like you'd swallowed a ramrod and it isn't becoming. Surely you've had time to recover from my little joke."
"Joke? Ha! I'll never get over it."
"Oh, yes, you will. You're just putting on this indignant front because you think it's proper and respectable. May I sit down?"
"No."
He sank into a chair beside her and grinned. "I hear you couldn't even wait 2 weeks for me," he said, and gave a mock sigh. "How fickle is woman?" When she didn't reply, he continued. "Tell me, Scarlet, just between friends, between very old and very intimate friends, wouldn't it have been wiser to wait until I got out of jail? Or are the charms of wedlock with old Frank Kennedy more alluring than illicit relations with me?" As always, when his mockery aroused wrath within her, wrath fought with laughter at his impudence.
"Don't be absurd."
"Then would you mind satisfying my curiosity on one point which has bothered me for some time? Did you have no womanly repugnance, no delicate shrinking from marrying not just one man but two for whom you had no love or even affection? Or have I been misinformed about the delicacy of our southern womanhood?"
"Rhett!"
"I have my answer. I always felt that women had a hardness and endurance unknown to men, despite the pretty idea taught me in childhood that women are frail, tender, sensitive creatures. But after all, according to the Continental Code of Etiquette, it's very bad form for husband and wife to love each other. Very bad taste, indeed. I always felt that the Europeans had the right idea in that matter. Marry for convenience and love for pleasure. A sensible system, don't you think?" "You are closer to the old country than I thought." how pleasant it would be to shout at him, "I did not marry for convenience." But unfortunately, Rhett had her there, and any protest of injured innocence would only bring more barbed remarks from him. "Oh, how you do run on," she said coolly. Anxious to change the subject, she asked, "How did you ever get out of jail?"
"Oh, that," he answered, making an airy gesture. "Not much trouble. They let me out this morning. I employed a delicate system of blackmail on a friend in Washington who's quite high in the councils of the federal government. A splendid fellow, one of the staunch Union patriots from whom I used to buy muskets and hoop skirts for the Confederacy. When my distressing predicament was brought to his attention in the right way, he hastened to use his influence, and so I was released." "Influence is everything, Scarlet. Remember that when you get arrested. Influence is everything, and guilt or innocence merely an academic question. I'll take oath you weren't innocent." "No, now that I'm free of the toils, I'll frankly admit that I'm as guilty as Cain. I did kill the nigger. He was uppity to a lady, and what else could a southern gentleman do? And while I'm confessing, I must admit that I shot a Yankee cavalryman after some words in a barroom. I was not charged with that peccadillo, so perhaps some other poor devil has been hanged for it long since." He was so blithe about his murders, her blood chilled. Words of moral indignation rose to her lips, but suddenly she remembered the Yankee who lay under the tangle of scuppernong vines at Terra. He had not been on her conscience any more than a roach upon which she might have stepped. She could not sit in judgment on Rhett when she was as guilty as he. "And as I seem to be making a clean breast of it, I must tell you in strictest confidence, that means don't tell Miss Pittypat, that I did have the money, safe in a bank in Liverpool."
"The money?"
"Yes, the money the Yankees were so curious about. Scarlet, it wasn't altogether meanness that kept me from giving you the money you wanted. If I'd drawn a draft, they could have traced it somehow, and I doubt if you'd have gotten a cent. My only hope lay in doing nothing. I knew the money was pretty safe, for if worst came to worst, if they had located it and tried to take it away from me, I would have named every Yankee patriot who sold me bullets and machinery during the war. Then there would have been a stink, for some of them are high up in Washington now. In fact, it was my threat to unbosom my conscience about them that got me out of jail.
Do you mean you actually have the Confederate gold?"
"Not all of it. Good heavens, no. There must be 50 or more ex-blockaders who have plenty salted away in Nassau and England and Canada. We'll be pretty unpopular with the Confederates who weren't as slick as we were. I have got close to half a million. Just think, Scarlet, $500,000. If you'd only restrained your fiery nature and not rushed into wedlock again." $500,000. She felt a pang of almost physical sickness at the thought of so much money. His jeering words passed over her head, and she didn't even hear them. It was hard to believe there was so much money in all this bitter and poverty-stricken world. So much money, so very much money, and someone else had it. Someone who took it lightly and didn't need it. And she had only a sick elderly husband and this dirty piddling little store between her and a hostile world. It wasn't fair that a reprobate like Rhett Butler should have so much, and she, who carried so heavy a load, should have so little. She hated him, sitting there in his dandified attire, taunting her. Well, she wouldn't swell his conceit by complimenting him on his cleverness. She longed viciously for sharp words with which to cut him. "I suppose you think it's honest to keep the Confederate money,"
Well, it isn't. It's plain out-and-out stealing, and you know it. I wouldn't have that on my conscience.
My, how sour the grapes are today, he exclaimed, screwing up his face. And just whom am I stealing from?
She was silent, trying to think just whom, indeed.
After all, he had only done what Frank had done on a small scale. Half the money is honestly mine, he continued. Honestly made with the aid of honest union patriots who were willing to sell out the union behind its back for 100% profit on their goods. Part I made out of my little investment in cotton at the beginning of the war, the cotton I bought cheap and sold for $1 a pound when the British mills were crying for it. Part I got from food speculation. Why should I let the Yankees have the fruits of my labor? But the rest did belong to the Confederacy. It came from Confederate cotton, which I managed to run through the blockade and sell in Liverpool at sky-high prices. The cotton was given me in good faith to buy leather and rifles and machinery with, and it was taken by me in good faith to buy the same. My orders were to leave the gold in English banks under my own name, in order that my credit would be good. You remember when the blockade tightened, I couldn't get a boat out of any Confederate port or into one, so there the money stayed in England? What should I have done? Drawn out all that gold from English banks like a simpleton? And tried to run it into Wilmington and let the Yankees capture it? Was it my fault that the blockade got too tight? Was it my fault that our cause failed? The money belonged to the Confederacy. Well, there is no Confederacy now, though you'd never know it to hear some people talk. Whom shall I give the money to? The Yankee government? I should so hate for people to think me a thief. He removed a leather case from his pocket, extracted a long cigar and smelled it approvingly, meanwhile watching her with pseudo-anxiety, as if he hung on her words. Plague take him, she thought. He's always one jump ahead of me. There is always something wrong with his arguments, but I can never put my finger on just what it is. You might, she said with dignity, distribute it to those who are in need. The Confederacy is gone, but there are plenty of Confederates and their families who are starving. He threw back his head and laughed rudely. You are never so charming or so absurd as when you are airing some hypocrisy like that, he cried in frank enjoyment. Always tell the truth, Scarlet. You can't lie. The Irish are the poorest liars in the world. Come now. Be frank. You never gave a damn about the late lamented Confederacy, and you care less about the starving Confederates. You'd scream in protest if I even suggested giving away all that money unless I started off by giving you the lion's share. Oh, I don't want your money, she began, trying to be coldly dignified. Oh, don't you? Your palm is itching to beat the band this minute. If I showed you a quarter, you'd leap on it. If you have come here to insult me and laugh at my poverty, I will wish you a good day, she retorted, trying to rid her lap of the heavy ledger, so she might rise and make her words more impressive. Instantly he was on his feet, bending over her, laughing as he pushed her back into the chair. When will you ever get over losing your temper when you hear the truth? You never mind speaking the truth about other people, so why should you mind hearing it about yourself? I'm not insulting you. I think acquisitiveness is a very fine quality. She was not sure what acquisitiveness meant, but as he praised it, she felt slightly mollified. I didn't come to gloat over your poverty, but to wish you long life and happiness in your marriage. By the way, what did Sister Sue think of your larceny? My what? You're stealing Frank from under her nose. I did not. Well, we won't quibble about the word. What did she say?
She said nothing, said Scarlet.
His eyes danced as they gave her the lie. How unselfish of her. Now let's hear about your poverty. Surely I have the right to know, after your little trip out to the jail not long ago. Hasn't Frank as much money as you hoped?
There was no evading his impudence. Either she would have to put up with it or ask him to leave. And no, she didn't want him to leave. His words were barbed, but they were the barbs of truth. He knew what she had done and why she had done it. And he didn't seem to think the less of her for it. And though his questions were unpleasantly blunt, they seemed actuated by a friendly interest. He was one person to whom she could tell the truth. That would be a relief, for it had been so long since she had told anyone the truth about herself and her motives. Whenever she spoke her mind, everyone seemed to be shocked. Talking to Rhett was comparable only to one thing, the feeling of ease and comfort afforded by a pair of old slippers after dancing in a pair too tight.
Didn't you get the money for the taxes? Don't tell me the wolf is still at the door of terror.
There was a different tone in his voice. She looked up to meet his dark eyes and caught an expression which startled and puzzled her at first, and then made her suddenly smile. A sweet and charming smile which was seldom on her face these days. What a perverse wretch he was. But how nice he could be at times. She knew now that the real reason for his call was not to tease her, but to make sure she had gotten the money for which she had been so desperate. She knew now that he had hurried to her as soon as he was released, without the slightest appearance of hurry, to lend her the money if she still needed it. And yet he would torment and insult her and deny that such was his intent should she accuse him. He was quite beyond all comprehension. Did he really care about her more than he was willing to admit? Or did he have some other motive? Probably the latter, she thought. But who could tell? He did such strange things sometimes. No, she said. The wolf isn't at the door any longer. I got the money.
But not without a struggle, I'll warrant. Did you manage to restrain yourself until you got the wedding ring on your finger?
She tried not to smile at his accurate summing up of her conduct, but she couldn't help dimpling. He seated himself again, sprawling his long legs comfortably.
Well, tell me about your poverty. Did Frank, the brute, mislead you about his prospects? He should be soundly thrashed for taking advantage of a helpless female. Come, Scarlet, tell me everything. You should have no secrets from me. Surely I know the worst about you.
Oh, Rhett, you're the worst. Well, I don't know what. No, he didn't exactly fool me, but suddenly it became a pleasure to unburden herself. Rhett, if Frank would just collect the money people owe him, I wouldn't be worried about anything. But Rhett, 50 people owe him, and he won't press them. He's so thin-skinned. He says a gentleman can't do that to another gentleman. And it may be months, and maybe never before we get the money.
Well, what of it? Haven't you enough to eat on till he does collect?
Yes, but... Well, as a matter of fact, I could use a little money right now. Her eyes brightened as she thought of the mill. Perhaps.
What for? More taxes?
Is that any of your business?
Yes, because you are getting ready to touch me for a loan. Oh, I know all the approaches, and I'll lend it to you, without, my dear Mrs. Kennedy, that charming collateral you offered me a short while ago. Unless, of course, you insist.
You are the coarsest?
Not at all. I merely wanted to set your mind at ease.
I knew you'd be worried about that point. Not much worried, but a little. And I'm willing to lend you the money, but I do want to know how you're going to spend it. I have that right, I believe. If it's to buy you pretty frocks or a carriage, take it with my blessing. But if it's to buy a new pair of breeches for Ashley Wilkes, I fear I must decline to lend it. She was hot with sudden rage, and she stuttered until words came. Ashley Wilkes has never taken a cent from me. I couldn't make him take a cent if he was starving. You don't understand him, how honorable, how proud he is. Of course, you can't understand him being what you are.
Don't let's begin calling names. I could call you a few that would match any you could think of for me.
You forget that I've been keeping up with you through Miss Pittypat, and the dear soul tells all she knows to any sympathetic listener. I know that Ashley's been a terror ever since he came home from Rock Island. I know that you have even put up with having his wife around, which must have been a strain on you.
Ashley is...
Oh, yes, he said, waving his hand negligently. Ashley is too sublime for my earthly comprehension. But please don't forget, I was an interested witness to your tender scene with him at 12 Oaks, and something tells me he hasn't changed since then. And neither have you. He didn't cut so sublime a figure that day, if I remember rightly. And I don't think the figure he cuts now is much better. Why doesn't he take his family and get out and find work and stop living in terror? Of course, it's just a whim of mine, but I don't intend to lend you a cent for terror to help support him. Among men, there's a very unpleasant name for men who permit women to support them.
How dare you say such things? He's been working like a field hand.
For all her rage, her heart was wrung by the memory of Ashley splitting fence rails. And worth his weight in gold, I dare say. What a hand he must be with the manure, and he's... Oh, yes, I know. Let's grant that he does the best he can, but I don't imagine he's much help. You'll never make a farmhand out of a Wilkes, or anything else that's useful. The breed is purely ornamental. Now quiet your ruffled feathers and overlook my boorish remarks about the proud and honorable Ashley. Strange how these illusions will persist, even in women as hard-headed as you are. How much money do you want, and what do you want it for? When she didn't answer, he repeated, "What do you want it for? And see if you can manage to tell me the truth. It will do as well as a lie. In fact, better. For if you lie to me, I'll be sure to find it out. And think how embarrassing that would be. Always remember this, Scarlet. I can stand anything from you but a lie. Your dislike for me, your tempers, all your vixenish ways, but not a lie. Now what do you want it for?" Raging as she was at his attack on Ashley, she would have given anything to spit on him and throw his offer of money proudly into his mocking face. For a moment she almost did, but the cold hand of common sense held her back. She swallowed her anger with poor grace and tried to assume an expression of pleasant dignity. He leaned back in his chair, stretching his legs toward the stove. "If there's one thing in the world that gives me more amusement than anything else," he remarked, "it's the sight of your mental struggles when a matter of principle is laid up against something practical like money. Of course, I know the practical in you will always win, but I keep hanging around to see if your better nature won't triumph some day. And when that day comes, I shall pack my bag and leave Atlanta forever. There are too many women whose better natures are always triumphing. Well, let's get back to business. How much and what for?"
"I don't know quite how much I'll need," she said sulkily. but I want to buy a sawmill. And I think I can get it cheap. And I'll need 2 wagons and 2 mules. I want good mules, too. And a horse and buggy for my own use.
A sawmill?
Yes. And if you lend me the money, I'll give you a half interest in it.
Whatever would I do with a sawmill?
Make money. We can make loads of money. Or I'll pay you interest on the loan. Let's see. What's good interest?
50% is considered very fine.
50? Oh, but you are joking. Stop laughing, you devil. I'm serious.
That's why I'm laughing. I wonder if anyone but me realizes what goes on in that head back of your deceptively sweet face.
Well, who cares? Listen, Rhett, and see if this doesn't sound like good business to you. Frank told me about this man who has a sawmill, a little one out Peachtree Road, and he wants to sell it. He's got to have cash money pretty quick, and he'll sell it cheap. There aren't many sawmills around here now, and the way people are rebuilding, why, we could sell lumber sky high. The man will stay and run the mill for a wage. Frank told me about it. Frank would buy the mill himself if he had the money. I guess he was intending buying it with the money he gave me for the taxes.
Poor Frank. What is he going to say when you tell him you've bought it yourself right out from under him? And how are you going to explain my lending you the money without compromising your reputation?
Scarlett had given no thought to this. So intent was she upon the money the mill would bring in. Well, I just won't tell him.
He'll know you didn't pick it off a bush.
I'll tell him... Well, yes, I'll tell him I sold you my diamond earbobs. And I'll give them to you, too. That'll be my my whatchacallit.
I wouldn't take your earbobs.
I don't want them. I don't like them. They aren't really mine, anyway.
Whose are they?
Her mind went swiftly back to the still hot noon with a country hush deep about Tara, and the dead man in blue sprawled in the hall.
They were left with me by someone who's dead. They're mine, all right. Take them. I don't want them. I'd rather have the money for them.
Good Lord, he cried impatiently. Don't you ever think of anything but money?
No, she replied frankly, turning hard green eyes upon him. And if you'd been through what I have, you wouldn't either.
I found out that money is the most important thing in the world, and as God is my witness, I don't ever intend to be without it again.
She remembered the hot sun, the soft red earth under her sick head, the niggery smell of the cabin behind the ruins of 12 Oaks, remembered the refrain her heart had beaten, "I'll never be hungry again. I'll never be hungry again."
I'm going to have money someday, lots of it, so I can have anything I want to eat. And then there'll never be any hominy or dried peas on my table. And I'm going to have pretty clothes, and all of them are going to be silk.
All?
All, she said shortly, not even troubling to blush at his implication. I'm going to have money enough so the Yankees can never take Tara away from me. And I'm going to have a new roof for Tara, and a new barn and fine mules for plowing and more cotton than you ever saw. And Wade isn't ever going to know what it means to do without the things he needs. Never. He's going to have everything in the world. And all my family. They aren't ever going to be hungry again. I mean it. Every word. You don't understand. You're such a selfish hound. You've never had the carpetbaggers trying to drive you out. You've never been cold and ragged and had to break your back to keep from starving.
He said quietly, I was in the Confederate Army for 8 months. I don't know any better place for starving.
The Army? Bah! You never had to pick cotton and weed corn. Don't you laugh at me!
His hands were on hers again as her voice rose harshly.
I wasn't laughing at you. I was laughing at the difference in what you look and what you really are.
And I was remembering the first time I ever saw you, at the barbecue at the Wilkes's. You had on a green dress and little green slippers, and you were knee-deep in men and quite full of yourself.